through the paper. Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality.
This is Malcolm Ross of Orange Juice, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
Moments before he's hit with a 40-foot wall of sulfuric acid that will horribly burn everything in its path. Now that's real acid, so I want to see goggles, people.
My eyes, the goggles do nothing.
It's almost always safety first at the Thingularity Radio program, so don't let that happen to you. Have your questions answered by sending them to catskillmakersinfo@gmail.com and tune in every first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM Accra or anytime at WGXC.org.
Turn out on Tuesdays from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the WGXC Catskill Studio to learn about Wavefarm's WGXC, tour the studio, record a station ID or PSA, or pick up a sticker. The WGXC Catskill Studio is located at 393 Main Street in Catskill. Come on by for a visit and see how you can get involved in your local community radio station.
Wavefarm's WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Marilyn Zola Coral of San Francisco, California.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies. Once again, or maybe for the first time ever, you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. The name of the show, Goodnight Norman, right here on WGXC.org on the worldwide interweb, WGXC 90.7 FM, broadcasting live on the air from Cairo, Accra, Catskill, Hudson, New York. Tonight, as promised earlier today, Lawrence Slater's book Opening Skinner's Box, Great Psychological Experiments of the 20th Century. I suppose, as I said before, I'm not a big fan of psychology and the ever-increasing ability of persons to diagnose and prescribe medications for themselves. That said, I'm tempted. This book has different chapters, and each one is devoted to one of the great psychological experiments of the 20th century, starting with B.F. Skinner and his test performed on rats and his own child, and which became for a while kind of Bible, so to speak, in America's understanding of the behavior, especially of its children. I suppose people have moved away to a certain extent from Skinner, but not really. Psychology is a weird fictional science, a pseudoscience, not based on much at all, except fiction and opinion and judgment and weird moral judgments, I guess, moral metrics. So the next chapter after Skinner is Stanley Milgram's Obedience to Authority experiment, in which you probably heard some variation thereof. Basically, the just following orders experiment. Told to zap people and whatnot. A lot of these guys were young when they did these things. The next one is kind of really interesting, I think. It's called On Being Sane and Insane Places, in which the author ostensibly repeats the experiment of another psychiatrist of the 60s, getting herself admitted to an asylum. Oh, she didn't get admitted. Instead, now she just gets... The earlier guy, the original guy, got admitted to a nut house, so to speak. Based on a simple sentence. It took him several weeks to get back out after his admission. She wasn't admitted. Instead, she was the author many years later. The original experiment was in the 60s. I'm sorry if I'm being vague. I'm trying to recap something without having written it down, a recap. So she went in, said she was crazy, or that she was hearing things, and was prescribed Risperdal. So they don't really admit you anymore to nut houses. That would be too much. Instead, they do something much more profitable for all involved. They prescribe you medications. But some of you think that's a good thing, and maybe it is. I don't know, I'm not going to read that one, though, even though I've read it. This one is called Obscura. It's called Stanley Milgram and Obedience to Authority, which is also relevant now, because many people are obeying authority around the world and right here at home. In fact, some of those who are obeying authority are those who are absolutely certain that they're not obeying authority, that they are in fact resisting authority. The funny thing is that by resisting authority, you're affirming the authority, and especially if you have no alternative to the authority other than to ask that authority to remain an authority, but just be nicer to you. It's kind of a silly protest, but it seems to be the only kind of protest people have come up with. Which again, like I say, is really just an obedience to the authority. It's an admission that that person is somehow got more authority than you have, and so you put your eggs in a basket and you say, hey, be nice to these eggs. They're in my basket, Mr. Authority. Or else you call on some other authorities and say, arrest this authority. He's a bad authority. We need a good authority. But the thing is, good and bad don't really relate to authority. So disobedience to authority is, in fact, authority. The only real alternative is to assume a certain authority, but that's not discussed here in this book, and I'm not going to discuss it any further tonight. Although, I'm definitely working on a discussion thereof, how to assume authority rather than to beg for, demand, plead with, or align oneself with some other authority. In the meantime, Lauren Slater from Opening Skinner's Box, Great Psychological Experiments of the 20th Century, Chapter 2, Obscura, Stanley Milgram and Obedience to Authority. In 1961, a 27-year-old Yale assistant professor of psychology, Stanley Milgram, wanted to study obedience to authority. In a post-Holocaust world, people were struggling to understand how scores of SS officers had shot, gassed, noosed, and otherwise tortured 12 million people to death, supposedly on orders from their commanders-in-chief. The generally accepted explanation had to do with the then-popular notion of the authoritarian personality, which hypothesized certain kinds of childhood experiences of a strict Teutonic caste produced people who would do anything to anyone if instructed. Milgram, a social psychologist, suspected this explanation was too narrow. He purportedly believed the answer to destructive obedience lay less in the power of personality and more in the power of situation. In Milgram's view, any especially persuasive situation could cause any rational human being to abandon moral precepts and, on orders, commit atrocities. To test his hypothesis, Milgram set up one of psychology's grandest and most horrible hoaxes. He created a fake but convincing shock machine. He recruited hundreds of volunteers and ordered them to deliver what they believed were lethal levels of electricity to an actor who feigned pain and even death. How far would people go under orders? What percentage of ordinary civilians would obey the experiment's mandates to shock? What percentage would rebel? Here's what he found. Part 1, the experiment. Possibly you are late. You are running down a small side street in New Haven, Connecticut. It's June 1961, and ahead of you loom the spires of the Yale Episcopalian Church. The streets smell of summer, wet crushed flowers and spoiled fruit, and maybe because of this you already feel a little ill, in anticipation, because of the odor, something sweet and singed in the air. Or perhaps you are not late. Perhaps you are the responsible type with minutes to spare, and so you are strolling and there is no moon because it is raining. A summer rain, darting down silver and sideways and making the street smell strongly of sewage and cement. In this scenario as well, you already feel a little sick in anticipation, although of what you cannot say. There is that odor, something rotting in the air. You're carrying the ad. Just 2 weeks ago, you ripped it from its newsprint page. We will pay you $4 for 1 hour of your time. Persons needed for a study of memory. And because it was Yale and because of the cash, enough to buy a new blender to replace the one that went kaput. And because, well, it's all in the name of science, you said yes. Now you are on your way. On your way. The side streets are so sideways, they curve and tip, the bricks buckling, green weeds thrusting up between the pavers. You trip, you straighten yourself up. You come to the address, Lindsley Chittenden Hall, a gray door, and you are just about to open it when it opens itself, and a man comes from the other side, his face all red, and could those be tears streaming down his cheeks? He hustles off into the shadows, and you, it's your turn. You go in. First off, you are paid. You go into a room, which is in worse shape than the sidewalk that led you here. Walls flaking, naked pipes and a complex meshwork on the ceiling, and a stern man in a white coat who gives you 3 fresh smackers and 4 quarters, cold in your palm. He says, "Here is your compensation. It is yours to keep, regardless of what happens," or some such thing, and what, you wonder, is going to happen. What's going to happen right now is I'm going to turn the page. Another man comes into the room. He's got a round face and a silly grin and a straw hat sideways on his head. He's got blue eyes. But they're not the ice blue of intelligence or the cornflower blue of passion. They're a bland, boiled blue. Even before all that happens, you think, this man does not look smart. His name, he says, is Wallace something or other. Hi, you say, my name's Goldfarb or Wentworth. Pick a name, any name will do. Just remember, either way, whatever name, this is you. The experimenter says, we are interested in learning about the effects of punishment on learning. There has been very little systematic research into this subject, and we're hoping our findings will be of some help to educational systems. In this experiment, one of you will be the learner and receive shocks when you make a mistake and word pairs read to you. The other will be the teacher who will administer the shocks when the word pair repetition is wrong. Now, which one of you would like to be the learner and which one the teacher? You look at what's his name, Wallace, and Wallace shrugs. You shrug. The experimenter says, we'll do a drawing. He holds out two pieces of folded paper, and you pick one, and Wallace picks one. You open yours. Teacher, it says. Thank God, Wallace says, laughing. Looks like I'm the learner. The experimenter motions for you and Wallace to follow him. You do. You go down a short, dark hallway and into a room that looks like a cell. Sit in this chair, the experimenter says to Wallace, and Wallace does. It's no ordinary chair. It's a goddamn electric chair with a switch plate on the table and straps and strange suckers to put on the skin. We've got to strap him down, the experimenter says, meaning strap Wallace down, and suddenly you're bending over this big man, buckling him into the seat as though he's just a baby, his skin, when you brush it, surprisingly soft. The experimenter takes a can of paste and says, rub this on his hands for the electrodes, and before you know it, you're massaging grease into this loose-fleshed man, and you feel oddly ill and a tad aroused, and the experimenter says, tighten those belts, and so you do. You grease and tighten, pulling the straps on the black belt so Wallace is harnessed and wired up, and just before you leave, you look at him, a captured man, his pale eyes a little scared, just a glint of fear, and you want to say, shh, nothing bad will happen here. Nothing bad will happen here. Nothing bad will happen here. You repeat that to yourself as you follow the experimenter out of the one cell-like room and into another cell-like room where there's no electric chair, but instead a huge generator with dime-shiny buttons beneath which are printed the voltages, 15, 30, 45, all the way up to 450. Danger, extreme shock, triple X, it says on the top-level levers. Jesus H. Christ, who is H? Did Jesus have a middle name? Haley, Halifax, Houston? You're starting to think seriously about Jesus' middle name. Sometimes this happens to you. You think about the wrong thing, so you won't have to think about the right thing. Halifax, Haley, Houston. And meanwhile, the experimenter is saying, you'll read these words sequences to Wallace through the microphone. For each mistake he makes, you give him a shock. You start at the lowest, 15, and you go up. May I give you a sample shock? Sure, you've always liked samples. Sample spoons of ice cream, sample fabric swatches, miniature shampoo samples in drugstores, so why not a sweet little sample shock? You offer your arm. It looks white and floppy in the fluorescent laboratory lights. It's an ugly arm with dark dots where the hairs spring up. The experimenter lowers some prong device onto your very own skin, and you feel a pair of hot fangs, the kiss of a stingray, and flinch away. That was 45 volts, the experimenter says, just so you know what the punishment is like. Okay, okay, you begin. Lake, luck, hay, sun. Tree, loon, laughter, child. The word pairs have a kind of poetry to them, and now you're happy. All these lakes and looms and Wallace, whose voice comes crackling at you through a tiny microphone, also seems happy. "Keep him coming, boy," he shouts, and you lob him chocolate, waffle, Valentine, Cupid. And that's when he makes his first mistake. He forgets the Cupid, unlucky in love. You give the first shock, just 15 volts, a kittenish tickle, nothing to worry about. But that first shock changes things. You can just tell. Wallace's voice, when he repeats the next word pair, is somber, serious, but goddammit, he makes another mistake. You give him 30 volts. Nice try. Next try. Good boy, he gets it right. And then again, he gets it right. You find you're rooting for him. And then he screws up Treehouse. Then he screws up Dahlia, Grass. And before you know it, you're up to 115 volts. You watch your finger land on the press pad, the nacreous nail, the knuckle, which is the hardest part of the hand. You press down. Through the microphone comes the sound of a scream. "Let me out! Let me out! I've had enough! Let me out of here!" You're starting to shake. You can feel wet crescents under your arms. You turn to the experimenter. "Okay," you say, I guess we gotta stop. He wants out. The experiment requires that you continue," his poker face says. "But he wants out," you say. "We can't continue if he wants out." "The experiment requires that you continue," he repeats, as though you're hard of hearing, which you're not. Your hearing's fine. So is your vision. 20/20. You have the absurd desire to tell this man all about your clean bill of health, and your excellent eyes, and your good grades in college, and your recent promotion at work. You want to tell Mr. White Coat that you're a decent person who has always wanted to help, who would do anything not to disappoint, but you're so sorry, you cannot continue the experiment. You have to, you hate to disappoint, but please continue, he says. You blink. Sometimes the sun blinks in and out on days when clouds scuttle across the sky. That's the best kind of day. Fresh blue sky, clouds as white as bandages, a crisp flag snapping at the tip of a pole. So you continue. Somewhere between the cloud and the flag, you find yourself going on. You don't know why. You hate to disappoint, and this experimenter seems so sure of himself, and as you continue, recall how once, when you were a child, there was an eclipse. The sun and the moon merged in a golden, burning minute. Wallace makes a mistake. He makes 3, 4 mistakes. Now you're up to 150 volts, and he's screaming. "I got a heart condition. Let me out of here. I no longer want to be in this experiment." The experimenter is standing right next to you saying, "Come on, please, the shocks are painful, but they're not harmful. There'll be no permanent tissue damage." You're fighting tears. Your name is Goldfarb or Weingarten or Wentworth. What is your name? You're not so sure. But he has a heart condition, you say. You think you say. Or is your mind just whispering to itself? "There'll be no permanent tissue damage," he repeats, and you shout, "For God's sake, what about temporary damage?" And he says, "The experiment requires that you continue." And you say you're crying now, or you're laughing now, your stomach's laughing, while your eyes are dribbling tears, and you say, "Why don't we just go in there and check on him? Let's just make sure he's okay." Mr. Whitecoat shakes his head. You can hear the bones click in his neck. Click, click, no, no, go on. You touch your own neck and you're shocked, no pun intended. You're shocked to feel how slippery wet it is from sweat. Also how oddly boneless it is. You press and press, but you cannot find any scaffolding in your neck. "Is this experimenter a doctor? Are you a doctor?" you ask. "Are you convinced there will be no permanent tissue damage?" He seems so sure of himself, just like a doctor, which you're not, and even though you got good grades in school, he knows what he's doing, and you don't. He wears a white coat, so you continue up the ladder of levers, reading word pairs, and something strange has happened to you. You concentrate totally on the task. You read each word pair carefully, carefully. You press the levers like a pilot at the panel. Your range of vision narrows to the mechanics at hand. You're flying into something. You're flying through something. But what it is, you cannot say. You have a job to do. This is not about the sky outside. This is not about the sun, bones, blinks, flags. You have a job to do. And so flesh fades away and Wallace fades away. And in his place, a gleaming machine. At 315 volts, Wallace gives one last blood-curdling scream and then stops. He falls silent. At 345 volts, you turn to the experimenter. You feel very odd. You feel hollow, and the experimenter, when he speaks, seems to fill you up with his air. "Consider silence a wrong answer," he says, and that seems so funny, you start to sneeze and laugh. You just laugh and laugh and press those levers because there's no way out. No way to say no, no, no. In your head, you can say it, but in your hands, you can't. And you understand now how great the distance between the head and the hands. It is miles of unbroken tundra. With your head, you say no, and with your hands, you tap dance up and down the shockboard, in and around the word skirt. Flirt, flare. Floor, swirl, goose, feather, blanket, star. And all the while, there's just this eerie silence punctuated by electric skillet sizzles and no man. There is no man here. It's like waking up. It is like falling asleep and dreaming of loons and sharks and then waking up and the whole thing is over. The experimenter says, "We can stop now." And through the door comes Wallace, his hat still sideways on his head, not a hair out of place. He looks fine. "Boy, you really shook me up in there," he says. "But no hard feelings." He pumps your hand. "Wow," he says, "you're sweating. Calm down. Calm down. Jeez, I'm known for my melodrama, but I'm fine." The experimenter echoes, "Wallace is just fine. The shocks weren't as bad as they seemed. The danger, lethal level, that's only for small laboratory animals, which is what we usually use the generator for." "Oh," you think. Wallace leaves. A spry little man named Milgram enters the room. "Do you mind if I ask you some questions?" And then he shows you a picture of a schoolboy being flogged and takes down your education level and whether you've ever been in the army and what religion you are, and you are so numb you answer everything, and you are also so confused. "So the shock generator was geared for mice, not men? Are you a mouse or a man? If Wallace really wasn't hurt, then why did he scream so loud? Why did he holler about his heart? You know about hearts. You know about bones and blood, which you happen to have on your hands." A rage rises up. You look at this nimble little Milgram and you say, "I get it. This wasn't about learning at all. This was an experiment about obedience, obedience to authority." And Milgram, who's only 27 years old and terribly young to be pioneering such a controversial, damaging, illuminating, and finally famous setup, Milgram turns to you. He has green eyes, the color of lollipops, and a little red scribble of a mouth. "This was about obedience. This was about obedience," you repeat, and Milgram says, "Yes, yes, it was. If you hadn't guessed it, I would have told you later in a standard letter I mailed to my subjects. 65% of my subjects behave just as you do. It is totally normal for a person to make the choices you did in the situation we put you in. You have nothing to feel badly about. But you won't be taken in. You won't be reassured. He fooled you once, but he won't fool you twice. There are no reassuring words for what you've learned in his lab tonight. Lake, loon, swan, song. You have learned you have blood on your hands and a body built for the words of other men. Other men. Maybe that one across the street or in the house next door, but not you. That is what you, the reader, may be thinking. Should you have had the outrageous luck to have found yourself in Lindsley Chittenden Hall at Yale University on a limpid June night in 1961, you would have not have done such a thing. Your name, after all, is not Goldfarb or Weingarten or Wentworth. You are perhaps a Buddhist, a vegetarian, a hospice volunteer. You work with troubled youth, or donate money to the Sierra Club, or cultivate the most amazing flocks, purple-pink clusters of miniature flowers in a city garden. Not you, but yes, you. For Stanley Milgram proved it to be true in Lindsley Chittenden Hall and then later in a lab in Bridgeport. And then still later in replications all around the world, 62 to 65% of us, when faced with a credible authority, will follow orders to the point of lethally harming a person. This seems improbable, impossible, especially because you are I am a humanist at heart. So were his subjects, many of them. I'm a good worker. I provide for my family. The only bad thing about me, I do get tied up in my work. I promise the kids to do something and take them somewhere, and then I have to cancel because I get called out on a job. I enjoy my job. I have an enjoyable family, 3 children. I like to grow flowers around my yard. I like to raise a vegetable garden, primarily because I like fresh vegetables. These were self-descriptions given by 2 of Milgram's fully obedient subjects after the testing. Fresh vegetables, flowers, those purple-pink flocks in our gardens. Prior to beginning to his experiment, Stanley Milgram, an assistant professor at Yale, took a poll. He asked a group of eminent psychiatrists how they thought subjects would behave in his simulated situation. He also polled Yale undergraduates and a handful of regular New Haven folks. All came up with the same prediction. People would not administer the shocks all the way. They would break off at 150 volts maximum, save for the pathological fringe of crypto-sadists who would play every lever as the victim screamed. Even today, 40 years after the lesson of Milgram has supposedly been learned, people still say, not me, yes, you. The power of Milgram's experiments lies perhaps right here, in the great gap between what we think about ourselves and who we frankly are. I'm going to pause for 2 reasons here. Okay, first reason accomplished. Second reason, I have to point out that 65%, as Milgram and the author are harping on, that leaves room for 35%. That's a third. That means a third of the people didn't do it. So a majority did, but a third didn't. And a third is almost a half. So, I don't know. Anyways, I mean, another half of a third, and then you're at a half. You know, 35 and 15 makes 50. Less than half of a third. So, I know, again, this is what my problem with psychology is, you know. And a lot of things, you know, people harp on a perspective. And she herself says this in the next chapter. She's like, you know, the diagnosis is about a perspective, a perception, a way of seeing a person. They say a weird thing and they're crazy. But that's just you. It's not them, not necessarily true. It's only weird to you. I say a lot of weird things. I even say I'm crazy, joking, just to put people at ease. But I really don't feel crazy. I've done some shitty things in my life, it's true, but it still wasn't crazy when I did them. At any rate, 35%. That's a lot of people who didn't go all the way up. But for some weird reason, this idea of a majority like persists in people's head, and then that majority becomes fact. Even if you say like a majority of people voted for Trump or didn't vote for Trump, the reality is probably that a majority of people didn't, because, again, a third of the people didn't vote. So that means a majority didn't vote for Trump, but also a majority didn't vote for Biden because, again, a third of the people didn't vote. There's always somewhere between a third and a half of the population that doesn't vote, which means that whoever wins is always not getting a majority. But people are like, it's the majority, it's the majority. It's like, so what if it's the majority? It doesn't make it the way that it is, absolutely. To say that 65% of the people tried to zap somebody to death, you're no longer interested. They're no longer interested in the 35% who didn't. Why aren't they interested in that 35%? Why are they like harping on the 65% who did the crazy thing? Why aren't they like trying to figure out what's going on in the heads of the 35%? That's all the psychologists are interested in, is the aberrant person. But they're supposed to be curing you from aberration, so... But if it's the majority that's doing it, then it's no longer an aberration. So then who's crazy? Are the people who are not trying to zap you to death, are they the crazy ones? So who's getting cured? And if we're curing the crazy ones who are the zappers, then why not use the non-zappers as your model? Why ignore the non-zappers and then just start delving into the minds of the zappers? That makes no sense. But here they go, harping on the zappers. Milgram was certainly not the first psychologist to experiment with obedience, nor the first psychologist to deceive his subject. The shock machine was utterly fake. The learner and the experimenter paid actors Milgram had hired to do the job. But he was the first to do so on both accounts systematically. Before Milgram, there was a mysterious experimenter by the name of C. Landis, who in an unnamed laboratory in Wales in 1924 found that 71% of his subjects were willing to decapitate a rat at the experimenter's insistence. But again, 71% of his subjects were willing, that means 30% were unwilling. Or 29%. So what? Why don't they say that? In 1944, a psychologist by the name of Daniel Frank realized he could get his subjects to perform the oddest acts just because he wore the white coat when he made the request. Please stand on your head. Please walk backward with one eye closed. Please touch your tongue to the window. It is unlikely that Milgram was influenced by these peripheral blips of research. For one thing, Milgram, who had aspired to become a political scientist, had not taken a single psychology course in his 4 undergraduate years at Queen's College, so he was by no means intimate with the literature of the field. For another, Milgram, a voluble little man, gave credit where credit was due. He points to the social scientist Solomon Asch as being the man who made him, if any one man can make another. While obtaining his graduate degree, Milgram served as Asch's research assistant at Princeton. Asch was hard at work on an experiment involving group pressure. In a study using lines of different lengths, Asch found his subjects would capitulate to the group's perceptions. So if the group said line A was longer than line B, even when it obviously wasn't, the baffled subject would say so too, abandoning his own beliefs in an effort to conform. I guess that's why everybody goes for the majority. But everybody doesn't. So anyways, back then, still now, Ash was a giant in social science research, but Milgram, inches shorter than he and smaller in stature in all sorts of other ways, would soon outpace his mentor. Milgram admired Ash, but lines lacked lyrical power, and Milgram, like Skinner, was a lyricist at heart. He wrote librettos and children's stories, quoted Keats and Rilke. He saw his 51-year-old father die of heart failure and always believed he, too, would go early. So he was powered by a bright light. "When we married," says his widow, Alexandra Milgram, "Stanley told me he wouldn't live past 51 because he looked just like his father. He always had a sense of his future as very short. Then when Stanley developed heart troubles in his 30s, he knew, and we both knew, his days were numbered. And perhaps it was for this reason he didn't want lines, something straight and narrow. He wanted to devise an experiment that would cast such a glow or a pall over the earth, it would leave something simmering for a long, long time. He wanted something huge, with heart. I was trying to think of a way to make Ash's conformity experiment more humanely significant," he said in an interview with Psychology Today. "I was dissatisfied that the test of conformity was judgments about lines. I wondered whether groups could presume pressure a person into performing an act whose human import was more readily apparent. Perhaps behaving aggressively towards another person, say by administering severe shocks." Milgram was no stranger to shocks. Even before he'd seen his father die, he knew about fear. He'd spent his childhood years in the South Bronx, where wildflowers grew in gutters and cockroaches scuttled across buckled linoleum. In his family's living room, heavy curtains clamped out sunlight, and the radio was big and boxy with a piece of bubbled glass protecting the channel pad. Milgram was fascinated by that radio. He was fascinated by its tiny plastic pores, its serrated dials that moved the white wand up and down. So there was music, now laughter, now weeping, now waltzing. So many sounds, but they always resolved into this. It was 1939, and Stanley was 6. It was 1942, and he was just on the cusp of a certain sort of deepening. Through the radio, which his family listened to every day because they had relatives in Europe, came the death reports and the sounds of the SS and shovels on hot concrete. He grew into adolescence with this as his background music, bombs and burns, and meanwhile his body was doing its own detonations. How confusing, sex and terror. We can only guess. It says so nowhere. In 1960, Milgram left Princeton and his mentor Ash to take an assistant professorship at Yale. Soon after his appointment, he began submitting expense reports for switches and electrodes. In the Yale archives are mock-up scripts and notes dated around that time in Milgram's handwriting. Audio cable through ceiling, sparks, practice electrode application procedure, James Justin McDonough, excellent victims, A-plus victim, perfect as victim, mild and submissive. Reading these notes, it is difficult to avoid the sense of Milgram as part imp, a little Jewish leprechaun, his science soaked in joke. In fact, Milgram did have a keen sense of comedy, and it may be more than any other scientist who has shown us, maybe he more than any other scientist, who has shown us how small the space between art and experiment, between humor and heartlessness, between work and play. Stanley loved what he did, says Mrs. Milgram. How could he not have? He used to address letters, drop them on the New York City sidewalks, and then observe who would pick them up, who would mail them, how, why. He developed a technique called cue barging, a kind of guerrilla social science in which Stanley sprung from a hiding place and darted into a line, all the while observing the reactions of those he had cut in front of. He went outside onto a bright blue day and pointed at the sky and timed how long it took to amass a crowd, all of whom stood there staring at nothing. He was ingenious, subversive, absurd. But unlike Sartre or Beckett, Milgram measured absurdity. He bottled it, says psychology professor Lee Ross of Stanford University. He bottled absurd behaviors in his lab so we could see them, study them. That's what makes him him. So Milgram put in orders for electrodes, 30 switches, black belts, audio equipment, all the props for the dangerous play he was about to enact. The play that would quite literally rock the world and put such a dent in his career he would never quite recover. He started with Yale students, and much to his surprise, every one of them complied, shocking their way blithely up the switchboard. Yale's, his wife Alexandra told me, he said, we can't draw any conclusions from Yale's. Says Mrs. Milgram, Stanley was sure if he went beyond the college community, he would get a more representative sample and more defiance. And so he did. Milgram put an ad in the New Haven Register, an ad calling for able-bodied men between the ages of 20 and 50. Factory workers, skilled laborers, professional cooks, other professionals. He recruited a young Alan Elms, then a graduate student at Yale, to help him find and keep a steady supply of volunteers. Elms, who is now 67 and teaches at the University of Davis, clearly remembers his work with Milgram. Elms' voice is slow and tired. I cannot help but think it's the voice of a man who has been shocked himself, seen something bad. Are you glad you were there? I ask him. Oh, yes, Elm says and sighs. It was a very, very powerful thing. It is not something you would forget. He pauses. I will never regret being involved. And so started the experiments, that summer of 1961, the summer of abnormally warm weather, of a bat infestation in the church's belfry. The summer you went stumbling down the side streets, ad clutched in your hand. Altogether, Milgram recruited, with Elms's help, over 100 New Haven men. He tested them almost always at night. This gave the whole thing a ghoulish air, which it did not need, for there were mock screams and skulls on the generator. Milgram alerted the area police. You may hear people being tortured. It's not true. It's an act. An act, apparently, that was quite convincing to the subjects who sweated and squirmed their way through at the experimenters' proddings. Many were visibly upset at being told to continue administering the shocks. One subject had a laughing convulsion so severe the experiment had to be stopped. Laughing? Why laughing? The odd thing was there was a lot of laughter going on, a lot of strangled hee-haws and belly-aching bursts. Some have said the laughter indicates that everyone knew Milgram, the imp, had struck again, that this was just a frivolous joke. Some say his subjects were laughing at him. Such an obvious bit of trickery. Elms disagrees. People were laughing out of anxiety. We were laughing, Milgram, and I, out of discomfort. Milgram and Elms observed the subjects behind a one-way mirror, and in between filming the unbelievable obedience they themselves could not have predicted, they dabbed at their eyes with hankies, for something here was horribly, horribly funny. That scholars and writers have used the laughter present during the experiment as a sign of its essential frivolousness shows little about the experiment and a lot about the rather simplistic notions we hold in regards to comedy, tragedy, and the connections between the two. Comedy and tragedy are inextricably intertwined in sign and symbol and etymology. Milgram himself laughed one moment and said in another that what he had discovered was terrifying and depressing. Alexandra, Milgram reports, the results, which he did not expect to be so high, made him cynical about people. Of course they did. Milgram had expected compliance, but not at the astounding rate of 65% of subjects willing to deliver what they believed were lethal shocks. I read it that way because this is a secondhand book, and somebody just underscored 65% of subjects willing to deliver what they believed were lethal shocks. Anyways, no, he had not expected that. In an attempt to coax more defiance out of his subjects, he varied the conditions. He moved the learner into the room with the subject and removed the microphone and had the subject deliver the shocks by forcing the learner's hand onto a metal plate. Compliance did drop then, but not by much. Terrifying, depressing, yes. A full 30% of subjects were willing to repeatedly slam the learner's hand onto the shock plate, endure the sound of his screams, and watch him slump over, all under orders from the experimenter. So now he's changed the experiment, and so 30% are willing to do this. So what happened to the other 30% from the original one that didn't? This is what I'm saying. Why is it just... Anyways, Milgram's experiment was funded by the National Science Foundation, also known to you as the NSF. The monies came in June, July, and August, passed in a sizzle of blue sparks. In September, only 3 months into the experiment, Milgram wrote to his backers telling them of the results. In a naive moment, some time ago, I once wondered whether in all of the United States a vicious government could find enough moral imbeciles to meet the personal requirements of a national system of death camps of the sort that were maintained in Germany. I am now beginning to think that the full complement could be recruited right here in New Haven. Well, I guess that's true. Imagine what it must have been like for Milgram as he was making these discoveries. Was he up at nights? Did he touch his children's faces and feel how they were not so soft? The jutting ridge of his daughter's cheekbones, the tiny white teeth? Did the normal New Haven streets take on shadow and curve? Milgram's discovery was not that people will hurt or kill one another. We've always known that to be true. Milgram's discovery was that people will do so in the absence of aggression. He effectively disentwined murder from rage, for his subjects were not angry. They were quiet, good folks with flocks in their gardens and children in cribs. Milgram was a social psychologist, which means he had to understand his findings primarily in terms of the situation, for that is social psychology's clarion call. In the eyes of social psychology, personality, who you are, matters less than place, where you are. And Milgram said he was demonstrating this. How any normal person can become a killer if he finds himself in a place where killing is called for. He used his experiments to greater and lesser degrees over the years to explain the appalling behavior at My Lai in Vietnam and in Nazi Germany, where his work is inextricably hitched to Hannah Arendt's thesis on the banality of evil, the bureaucratic Eichmann blandly taking orders, propelled by forces external to him. Today, years and years after Milgram's experiment, social psychologists still sound this bell, proclaiming that what matters is context, not psyche, says Lee Ross, co-author of The Person in the Situation, Perspectives of Social Psychology. I wouldn't say there are no stable character attributes in a person that contribute to moral or immoral behavior, but they are far outweighed by where the person is in at what time and with whom. In other words, Ross and his colleagues claim that our behaviors do not result so much from a stable set of internalized preferences or beliefs, but rather from external influences that change like wind and weather. Milgram ascribed to this general worldview, yet on closer inspection, there are glitches that suggest he was not so sure. For instance, if he believed it was all or mostly situation that propelled his volunteers, then why did he administer a personality test at the end of each session? Why did he gather data on education, religion, military service, and gender? Why did he later, as a professor at City College of New York, chair a doctoral dissertation that took as its subject the individual character traits of nonconformists by a young Sharon Presley? Something in the subject must have interested him. Not long after the initial experiments, Milgram and Elms went on a hunt for personality traits that correlate with obedient or defiant behavior. They did follow-up studies of their subjects, scrutinizing their lives and psyches for clues as to who did what and why. This, understand, is a no-no in the field of social psychology, snorts Ross. It's personality stuff. We don't do that. Milgram didn't do that. But he did. He went with Elms and measured individual men and wrote a paper or two. He could only have done this because he knew the situation was not a total explanatory factor. He knew the situation was not a total explanatory factor. Listen, if it had been, if Milgram had created a situation so all-embracing and solidly persuasive, then he would have achieved 100% obedience. But he achieved 65%, which means 35% defied the experimenter and the situation. Why? Why? This is a question no social scientist, psychologist can answer. It is at this critical juncture that social psychology breaks down. It can tell you about aggregate behavior, but it can tell you nothing about the naysayers, the exotic tendrils that curl off the main frame and give sprout to something strange. Here, Milgram had devised a study in which 35% of his plants, to extend the metaphor, came up crimson, hybrid. It was not the soil. It must have been something in the seed. In the mid-60s, Milgram and Elms called subjects back to the lab and administered batteries of personality tests. One was called the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. And I took that test. Another, the Thematic Appreciation, the Thematic Apperception Test. Elms did extensive one-on-one interviewing, asking obedient and defiant subjects about their childhoods. Their relationships with their mothers and fathers. Their earliest memories. They found very little. Catholics were more obedient than Jews. We did find that, Elms tells me. The longer one's military experience, the more obedient. We also found defiant volunteers measured higher on the MMPI social responsibility scale, sighs Elms. That scale supposedly measures not only greater concern for social and moral issues, but also a tendency towards compliance and acquiescence. So what do we learn from that? Not much. That could describe either an obedient or a defiant subject. It was very difficult for Elms and Milgram to find any consistent character traits in defiant versus obedient subjects. They did find that obedient subjects reported being less close to their fathers during childhood than defiance did. As children, they found that obedience received either spankings or very little punishment, whereas defiance had been punished by severe beatings or some kind of deprivation. Dinner, perhaps. Slightly more obedience had served on active military duty. Most obedience in the military admitted to shooting at men. Most defiance denied it. Well, that's it. I'm only halfway through the chapter. Chapter 2 of Lawrence Slater's opening Skinner's Box, Great Psychological Experiments of the 20th Century. The title of the chapter, Obscura, about Stanley Milgram's experiments on why people